If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Hola.
Hello, this call is being translated.
Abuela, listen to what my phone can do.
Abuela, escucha lo que mi teléfono puede hacer.
Wow, ahora dime sobre tu novia nueva.
Wow, now tell me about this new girlfriend.
Huh?
Tú sabes lo que dije.
You know what I said.
Language is no longer a barrier thanks to Live Translate with Galaxy AI on Samsung Galaxy S24 Ultra. Learn more at Samsung.com. Samsung account login required. Calls must be made using the native Samsung dialer.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorn. The guest on today's podcast is the historian and writer Guy Bowman. He's here to discuss his new book, The Indian Contingent, which tells the story of the forgotten Muslim soldiers of Dunkirk. Putting the questions to Guy was our production editor, Spencer Mizzen.
Guy, why did you think the story of the Indian Contingent was one that needed telling?
Well, I think because, Spencer, it's a great story. It's a really good story. It's a story that was unknown, that was forgotten. But it's a story that I think really is really valuable, important, useful for 21st century Britain and for a new way of looking at the Second World War. You know, I think we have the Second World War is kind of embedded within consciousness in this country, embedded within the way people think, and it keeps coming up and again and again, often in a quite a politicized way, and a very limited and simplified way. And I think we need to broaden our understanding in the UK of what the war was about. And this is one very particular story about something that happened here in Britain, which really will, I think, really help people to broaden that understanding.
Sure. Now, this is a story of an Indian contingent that was in northern France in the first year of the Second World War, and they were evacuated from France, from Dunkirk in 1940. Can you just give us a bit of background? What were they doing in northern France in the first place?
So the British Army, the British Expeditionary Force, was sent to France in September of 1939 and then built up over the course of that winter. And at that stage, the British Army had no animal transport. There was no, all of the Royal Army Service Corps, the British Royal Army Service Corps, was all focused on motor transport, on trucks and indeed on trains. And they realized quite quickly that they were going to need some animal transport for situations where it was muddy or where there was where it was very cold, or getting up to the front line in a situation where they couldn't, where an engine would alert the enemy. But the British Army had no animal transport. I mean, the phrase that they used was, there is not a horse in the force. And so they looked to India. And in India, they had more than 30 animal transport companies, which were being used on the Northwest frontier and elsewhere. And so the planners said, okay, we will go to India. So that was the demand. That was the need within the British Army in that first winter of the British Expeditionary Force, was delivering munitions and supplies, engineering supplies, all kinds of supplies to the front line.
And can you tell us a little bit more about the men who staffed the Indian contingent? And am I right in saying they were mainly Muslims? And what were their motivations for joining the army?
Yeah, they were mainly Muslims. They were from Punjab, which is in the northwest corner of India. And now, of course, Punjab is divided between India and Pakistan. The border went in 1947. The partition went through Punjab. They were guys mostly Muslims, because Punjab is the home of Sikhs, but it's also the home of very large amount of Muslims, and so the British Army had this policy of what they called martial race theory. So the idea that there were these martial races, there were these groups of men who were inherently warlike, who it was in their blood, and they would always make good soldiers. And the Sikhs were a martial race, and indeed what they called the PMs, the Punjabi Mohammedans or the Punjabi Muslims, were also martial races. And so what they did in the Royal Indian Army Service Corps, so these guys were part of that big corps, the Royal Indian Army Service Corps, what they did there was to have each company was recruited from a different martial race or a different sector of Indian society. And a lot of them were PM companies, Punjabi Mohammedan companies. And when they put together this force that they called Force K6, which was basically four of these companies, each of which was around 320 men, then they said, as a policy decision, we will use entirely Muslims from Punjab, and which makes it easier for supply and for organization and for all kinds of things. They made that policy decision at the beginning. And so when they shipped out over, when they left in December 1939, they left Bombay, there were a handful of men in the among the 1,700 and so of them who were not Muslims, but literally only a handful. And they were principally the sweepers and a few others amongst them.
So what did the soldiers from the subcontinent make of life in northern France? It must have been a bit of a culture shock to them.
It was a terrible culture shock. I mean, when they arrived on December the 26th, so on Boxing Day, 1939, and they spent the first couple of weeks in camps near Marseille. So, okay, Marseille is in the south of France. You know, we kind of think it's sunny and hot there, and it often is in the summer, but that winter was particularly cold and wet. And the camp where they were in the south of France was very, very muddy. And they were very unhappy there for the first couple of weeks. Then they got on trains and went up to northern France, and then they went into one of the coldest winters of the 20th century. You know, temperatures were way down below zero, and their mules were on the back of these trains, and they had to heat up the water so that the mules could drink it. You know, it was actually frozen. And they were, you know, they had to give extra blankets for the mules as well. So it was very, very tough. I mean, I think it was tough on the, you know, on the British soldiers who were there as well, and the French soldiers, but particularly tough on these guys from Punjab. And there's some very interesting, well, there's film footage, but there's also some drawings in the Illustrated London News by one of the war artists who went out and sketched them. So they're kind of in a dugout, huddling together in a Nissen hut, you know, and there's this kind of, they're smoking shisha pipes and drinking cups of tea, yeah, and looking, you know, you can tell even in this drawing that they're really cold. And then in this film footage, which was a little bit later, Major Akbar's in that film, and Lord Gort, who was the commander-in-chief of the British Expeditionary Force, and also the Minister of Defence, are touring around, and it's snowing, you know, and there's snow on the ground, you know, and they're looking at the mules, and it's like, cool, that's, you know, you sign up to join the army, but then you go into this cold, you know, wintry atmosphere. So it was pretty tough at first. It was pretty tough for them.
And what kind of action did they see in those first few months of the war?
Well, they were never designed to be, you know, I mean, they didn't have any rifles. They weren't armed. Every company had, I think, 4 pistols and 6 sabers between them, which were kind of pretty much, right, you know, ceremonial. So they were not designed to be fighting troops. Later, after they were evacuated to Britain, then they had training in rifles, in the use of rifles. What they were doing, they had carts. Okay, so every cart had one driver, one mule driver, and 2 mules. And they would use these to transport stuff. So, for example, there's photos of them at the railway station, and they carry stuff from the railway station to the dump. And this would be food, but much more often it was Royal Engineering supplies. So it would be, you know, wire, barbed wire, and sacks, you know, and concrete, and all kinds of sort of engineering supplies for making the defences along that small sector of northern France. They were just north of Lille. They were north of Lille, and then they were a little bit further and east of that. So kind of building that front line that the British Expeditionary Force expected to be occupying when the Germans invaded, which, of course, everyone knew was going to happen.
And what did the white British soldiers make of the Indian contingent? Was there much interaction between the two sets of troops?
Yeah, there was some interaction. I haven't found much in the way of information about that. I mean, there are, for example, there's some nice photos of a football match. There was a football match between the British Army and the French Army, and sitting in the stadiums, some of these Indian soldiers with their puggris, their helmet, their turbans on, watching the football match. And then there's another photo of an Indian soldier, because they were in small, you know, each company was posted attached to a corps or a division, so they were in very small groups, so they were interacting with the British guys and indeed the French civilians around them all the time. And you know, there's some nice photos from that, and there's a bit of film footage of them with some Royal Engineers where they're smoking, they're sharing cigarettes together, and then they do this kind of staged thing where they all walk off together arm in arm, looking very jolly. So yeah, they were quite close together. I mean, and also there's a beautiful, towards the end of April, when the weather had improved, they were doing, in this little part of Lille, they were doing Gymkhana. So they were performing wonderful, you know, like stunts on the back of mules, and dancing, and playing music. And they invited all of the people of the village to come and see them. And so there's a lovely photo from the Imperial War Museum of the civilians and the children and the Indian soldiers all together watching something that's happening out of shot, and they're all kind of smiling and laughing at that. And that, of course, you know, and these guys are dancing, and they're, it's very, yeah, very relaxed. And this was probably the first time that Bhangra had been danced in France, and certainly when they came over to the UK as well, they were dancing here as well. So there's a kind of, I mean, they were very, very sociable. They loved children, you know. They liked they would go to cafes in France, and they weren't drinking, of course, weren't drinking alcohol, but they would have, you know, sweet tea or syrup, apparently, was what they liked in the cafes.
In your research, were you able to find out many personal stories about the sort of the rank and file troops, like where they came from, what jobs they did?
Yes, it was difficult. I mean, that was really what I was looking for were those, as you say, the personal stories of the rank and file. So there were two Indian officers amongst them, and I found lots of stories about them, and some of the stories of the viceroy's commissioned officers as well. But the actual kind of drivers themselves was very difficult. I mean, I went to Pakistan on my research, and I was hoping to find, you know, in the UK, you know, my father was in the Second World War, my grandfather was in the First World War. A lot of British families have got, you know, they've got a story or two, or they've got some letters, or they've got photos or something. And I was hoping to find the same thing in Pakistan. I was hoping that I would find a drawer full of letters or a load of photographs or even some kind of artifacts. And I really found very, very few of those. So it's hard to know, really. I mean, the stories that I have are from people like, there was one, you know, there's one boy who I found out a little bit about when I met his family in a little village called Rajoha in Punjab in Pakistan. And I met his nephews, and he was 16 in 1939, so he was pretty young. Mm. And he was what they called a bellows boy. So, of course, these guys were going with their mules, and indeed horses, a few horses as well. And so they needed horseshoes and mule shoes, and they needed those to be made. So they had farriers, and then they needed them to be fitted. So they had this team of a blacksmith and what they called bellows boy and hammermen. And this young man, whose name was Aurangzeb, he signed on as a bellows boy, the age of 16. He went with them from Punjab to Bombay, across the ocean to Marseille, and then up to the north of France, which must have been a hell of a trip for a 16-year-old boy from a farm background. And tiny little village. I visited it a couple of years ago, and he was there as part of that group there, who's part of the 25th Company. And his nephews remembered that he used to write poetry, so he would write poems for them and send them home, poems in Urdu and poems in Punjabi. Unfortunately, a couple of years later, he after they came back to Britain, he got TB, which was one of the things that, for various medical reasons, that they used to suffer from quite a lot. He caught TB, he was hospitalised, and he died. And he's buried in Brecon in Wales, where there are actually 8 of them buried.
Okay, can you tell us a little bit about the retreat to Dunkirk and the evacuation itself, please?
Sure. Yeah. Well, these guys, so right up in the north of France, two companies, and 10th of May, the Germans attack, and there's this terrible upheaval and craziness, and no one quite knows what's happening. And within a short, very short period of time, it all goes really badly wrong. The companies, the 25th Company and the 32nd Company, stayed where they were initially, and then they got the order to retreat to Dunkirk. And so they did so through a very, you know, a narrowing corridor, with the Germans coming in both from the north through Belgium, but also increasingly from the south, where they had raced to the sea and cut off the British Expeditionary Force and large amounts of the French army as well. And so they decided, or, well, it's interesting contrast of stories here. There is some doubt about the truth of some of the stories. So in the 32nd Company, which was the company that was further away from the coast, one of their officers, who was a chap by the name of Ashdown, Captain John Ashdown, he reported to his family that he was ordered to abandon the men, abandon the equipment, abandon the mules, abandon everything, and just go to the coast. Now, that story isn't substantiated anywhere else, but it's a story that has kind of hung on within his family. And that story has come to be known because the son of this Captain Ashdown was Paddy Ashdown, the British politician, the Lib Dem politician. And so it's kind of, that story has been widely talked about. Whether or not it's true, I'm not sure. But as I say, there's no documentary evidence for it in the archives. So they fled to the coast. And then the 25th Company, which is Akbar's company, did the same thing. And we know a little bit more about them because their diary is more intact. Their war diary is more intact. We know that they stopped at various places. We know, for example, that there's some testimony from the Worcestershire Regiment about their carrier platoon, their Bren gun carrier platoon, how they arrived at this village where the Indians were just leaving, and then the Indians gave them a meal of chicken and bread, which they had cooked, and so they were very happy about that, because every company, of course, had its own cooks, and they were cooking chapatis, you know, furiously every day, cooking chapatis. And the 25th Company eventually got to the coast on the 28th of May, which was the third day, if I'm correct, of Operation Dynamo. And they got onto the beaches at Malo-les-Bains, which is to the east of Dunkirk itself, a little bit just towards the Belgian frontier. And they rested behind the dunes. And on the next day, they went onto the beach. And there they saw the devastation of the beach of Dunkirk, with the Luftwaffe flying overhead and shells coming in as well, and the little ships trying to come up to the beach, while the further to the left, to the south, the mole that was being used to take off the majority of men, and the confusion was terrible. So their commanding officer, he tried to find some transport, because some of the men in the company were injured, including their Molvi. Every company had a Molvi with them, which was like an imam, someone who would lead the prayers. The commanding officer went off to try and find some transport, failed to do that. So Akbar led the men marching along the beach in the middle of the afternoon. And I can picture the scene, really. I mean, it's an extraordinary idea. So there's 300 of them, possibly still wearing their turbans. I like to think they were still wearing their turbans, but maybe wearing the steel helmets by this stage. And all of the British Tommies lining up on the beach. And again, of course, the shells coming in. The Luftwaffe weren't so busy on that day, because the weather was quite cloudy, so they couldn't see so well. They marched along the beach. They got to the Eastern Mole. They got split up because of the terrible crush of people there. They had to wait a very long time. And eventually, in the middle of the night, they all got taken off in different ships. Unfortunately, nowhere is recorded which ships they were taken by, but they were taken off from the mole and taken across to Dover, where they arrived at 9 o'clock on the morning of the 29th.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
So, yeah, absolutely. That idea that Britain was doing it alone is a very much a false idea, but it's an idea that still has a lot of traction these days.
We don't always realise just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger. Talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it, so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Hola.
Hello. This call is being translated.
Abuela, listen to what my phone can do.
Abuela, escucha lo que mi teléfono puede hacer.
Wow. Ahora dime sobre tu novia nueva.
Wow. Now tell me about this new girlfriend.
Huh?
Tú sabes lo que dije.
You know what I said.
Language is no longer a barrier, thanks to Live Translate with Galaxy AI on Samsung Galaxy S24 Ultra. Learn more at Samsung.com. Samsung account login required. Calls must be made using the native Samsung dialer.
So, Guy, you tell this in the book, a wonderful anecdote of the Indian contingent borrowing brass trays and playing Punjabi folk music when they arrived back in Dover. Just wonder if you could just expand on that a little bit, please.
Sure, yeah. So this comes from Akbar's memoir, which he wrote many years later. He's talking about the 25th Company arriving in Dover on the 29th of May. So right in the middle of that period of the evacuation, where there must have been thousands of men pouring through Dover every hour. And he said they'd taken straight to the railway station, where the lady volunteer workers offered tea and biscuits to every one of us. And then they were told that they had to wait for a while because there weren't any trains immediately. Some of the mule drivers went to the lady workers and requested to lend them their empty brass trays and copper buckets in which the workers had been carrying tea to serve the troops. Though the lady workers were puzzled at the request, he says, they lent them the utensils. In a moment, to the astonishment of all, this group started playing folklore tunes on these utensils. Our entire party joined in singing and dancing. Even the lady workers and many British spectators joined in the dance. The whole show was spontaneous. It went on with great enthusiasm till the guard gave the warning whistle. So you can just picture the scene at Dover Station, you know, with all these Tommies and also a few French soldiers, you know, coming, and there's the WVS and there's all the you know, the kind of the helpers, you know, with cups of tea and sandwiches and bananas and so on. And there come these Indian soldiers with their brown skin and their puggeries. And, you know, everyone's depressed and anxious, and maybe they're a little bit elated to be out of the hell of Dunkirk. And suddenly there's a Punjabi Bhangra music going, and they're dancing around right there at the station. It must have been quite an amazing sight.
So that was quite some entrance to the country then.
Exactly, yeah.
So what happened to them next? What happened after Dunkirk?
So that was the autumn, the summer going into the autumn of 1940, with the fear of invasion, the Battle of Britain, you know, the bombing, and these guys were very much in the heart of that. So initially they were sent into different areas. One company was sent to Glasgow, where a consignment of French mules had just arrived, because they had to leave all their mules in France, right? So all of their animals, all of their equipment, everything was still in France. And a number of about 300 French mules arrived in Glasgow. Some of the 25th Company go up there, pick them up, and then take them right up to the north of Scotland to a town called Laigh. And there they stay for a while. Others were near Doncaster. And a lot of them were concentrated at Ashbourne in Derbyshire. And they, you know, they didn't have a role particularly at this time. So they were helping with the agriculture. They were singling beet, and they were harvesting flax. And there's a story from the Daily Mirror about how they were cutting the flax and how they were singing songs as they did that, and how a girl who was one of the land girls there was there with them and was very impressed by their agricultural skills, because of course they all came from agricultural backgrounds. So there was a kind of not sure what they were doing at first.
And so what did Britons make of them, and what did they make of Britain?
That's a great question. What did they make of Britain, and what did Britain make of them? I mean, I think they were relieved to be out of France, relieved to be away from the battles. I think they settled down quite quickly, and they started to enjoy it. And I think the people started to enjoy their being here as well. I mean, the thing is that they were never in big places. They were almost always in villages and towns around the fringes. So kind of in the southwest of England, in Wales, South Wales, and North Wales, and a lot of time in the Highlands of Scotland. So they were meeting people. On the whole, they were meeting people who weren't, you know, sophisticated city dwellers. They were kind of rural British folk who were having a war that was quite different, really, from that that was experienced in, you know, even a small city like Exeter or certainly in London. They were making friends. I mean, the truth of it is that actually wherever they went, they made friends. They made some very strong relationships with people in different parts of the UK. There's lots of photos of them, people who took, you know, a photo of them standing outside the house, or there's a lovely photo of two carpenters, one British, well, Welsh carpenter, in fact, and one Punjabi carpenter standing together at Crick Cowell in Wales. There's lots of photos like that. And they had romantic relationships as well.
All right. Can you expand on that at all? Do you have any more details?
Absolutely. Yeah. There are lots of stories of romances. There were at least 8 babies left behind. And I've talked to one of those babies, who's now a gentleman in his 70s. And his story is absolutely wonderful. And you can find the story in the book, The Indian Contingent. And it's a story of love and affection and romance. And it's also a story of rejection as well, and a story of prejudice, because his mother, who was a Cornish woman from St. Austell, his father was one of these Indian soldiers, and his mother was a Cornish woman from St. Austell who was already married with 2 children from her Cornish husband. The mother never told her son who his real father was, even though she lived up until, you know, around the year 2000. So this boy, and indeed his younger brother, grew up thinking that their dad was this other white Cornishman. But actually, he was this Indian soldier who we only know that his name was Jamal Khan. He came and stayed with his mum while the other dad, the white father, was off working in Plymouth. And they made a very strong relationship. When he had to leave, to go back to Punjab, he was very unhappy about it, the father. He would send parcels and presents for years afterwards. There are other stories of romance. There's a lovely story by a soldier called Yakub Mirza, who was a guy, he was from Mirpur, which is in Kashmir, and he was posted to Scotland. He was up in a town called Knock, which is a village, really. It's famous for its distillery. And he was posted there. And he this guy had a lot of chutzpah. He had a lot of, you know, bravery. And his English was pretty good as well. And I think, you know, their English was quite mixed, these soldiers. But this guy, Yakub Mirza, he went to a dance. He saw a beautiful girl. And he fell in love with her. And he found out where she lived. And he went to visit her. And she fell in love with him as well. And they had this kind of this hand-holding romance. And he describes it beautifully because he actually wrote about it years later. And they had this hand-holding romance in her mother's house, which is just very beautifully described and very touching. And then he was posted off again somewhere else, and he had to part from her at the railway station. And he never saw her again, except he did, because years later he migrated back to Britain. So he came back to the UK and lived in Nottingham, where he died not just a couple of years ago, in fact, lived in Nottingham. And many years later, he found this woman, Isabel, her name was, whom he'd been in love with when he was a young man and when she was a young girl, and they were reunited. They were both been married in the meantime, but they were reunited at the railway station and were very happy to see each other. That kind of the length of that friendship that carried on even though they were separated in time and separated in space is very touching.
So did they spend the rest of the war in Britain?
Until the beginning of 1944. So yeah. there were some soldiers coming and some soldiers going. But basically they stayed here until beginning of 1944. Then they went back to India. So that was the period when Britain was gearing up for D-Day. But in India, it was still the war in Burma was still raging. And in fact, it wasn't until later that year that actually the Indian 14th Army, the 14th Army started to push the Japanese back in the far northeast of India. So they were needed more at that stage. They were needed more in India than they were in the UK.
Right, Guy, the historian Yasmin Khan writes in the foreword to your book that the Indian contingent's contribution to the war effort was widely recognised in Britain in the years after the war, but this public memory then lapsed. I mean, why do you think that was the case?
That's a really good question. That's a question about how collective memory works and how it is that that people and that countries remember some things and forget other things. And I think the answer to that is that in 1945, the country changed very rapidly. So we've just had the VE Day celebrations, the 75th anniversary of VE Day, and we're kind of approaching the 75th anniversary of VJ Day, which was actually the end of the war. And part of that was that, you know, that there was a desire to move on. People wanted to try and forget some of the trauma, you know, the terrible experience of those who'd been on the front line, but also those who'd been here in this country and the Blitz and the bombings that had carried on, you know, even with the V1 and the V2. And there was a new government, you know, by the time of the VJ Day, there was a Labour government, surprisingly to everyone, this Labour landslide. Churchill had proven to be unpopular in time of peace. And so there was a sense of Britain wanting to rebuild, to move on, but also to move on from the empire. I mean, in 1947, India and Pakistan and what became Bangladesh got their freedom, got their independence. And so that was, I think there was a feeling in the UK that actually we wanted to start to forget those kind of things. And so if you look at the way, if you track it through kind of popular culture, if you look at the films and the TV that was produced in the 50s and then the 60s and 70s, the kind of things that I grew up watching, you know, it's all about prisoners of war and escapes from POW camps. It's about the RAF. It's about particularly the first few years, it's about the resistance. It's about the North Africa as well, you know, the battles there. It's not really about the home front. It's not really about that first, you know, the British Expeditionary Force. I mean, there was one film about Dunkirk with John Mills in, I think, 1957. But it's part of a kind of general reframing, if you like, a reframing and reimagining and repositioning how Britain wanted to see the war because of how Britain wanted to see itself in this strange time when the empire was going, when the country was financially broke, when a lot of buildings were physically broken, needed to be rebuilt. And so there was a refocusing, I think, I guess is the way to put it.
So do they somehow not fit into the narrative that Britain fighting alone?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, that is such a, particularly in the summer of 1940, you know, that idea, yeah, Britain is fighting alone and we are going to carry on. And then also that idea that Britain won the war almost by itself with maybe a bit of help from the Americans, you know, which completely overlooked that the major loss of life was by the Soviet Union and completely forgets the fact that China had been fighting for years before anyway. And completely ignores the empire, the massive contribution of the white dominions like Canada, Australia, New Zealand, South Africa, and you know the empire colonies like African colonies, India, you know, the West Indies. So yeah, absolutely, that idea that Britain was doing it alone is a very much a false idea, but it's an idea that still has a lot of traction these days.
Now, there was quite a lot of controversy surrounding Christopher Nolan's blockbuster film Dunkirk a couple of years back and the conspicuous absence of Indian troops within that. I mean, do you see that film as being something of a missed opportunity in telling the Indian contingent story?
It was a great film. I really liked that film. And I think Nolan made a lot of, you know, artistic choices to focus it quite narrowly. And I think I would say that if probably the French have a greater right to be aggrieved by what was omitted or how they were presented in that film. And he completely omitted any mention or any shot of the Indian soldiers. But then there were 630 amongst 238,000, and they were there at a particular time or two particular times. I don't know. I mean, I think the opportunity is still there. I think because they're very visual, they're very visually appealing, these soldiers. You know, they look interesting. They've got mules, they've got turbans. You know, they're singing and dancing, literally, on occasion. So I think there's another film that's out there begging to be made, you know, by some Gurinder Chadha or some great British Asian filmmaker, take this idea and make it a whole new film about it. And I think, you know, I'm sure Christopher Nolan will be happy to see that, as everyone else will be.
That was Guy Bowman. His book, The Indian Contingent, The Forgotten Muslim Soldiers of Dunkirk, is out now, published by the History Press. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt and Jack Bateman. Tune in tomorrow for another lecture from our Medieval Life and Death Day event.